Hello and welcome to this episode of Let's Talk About by Kangaroo Minds. I'm Vedika and today we have with us James Hatchman. James is the CEO and co-founder of Voice of Health, which is a preventive-based mental health app which connects users to active listeners. The aim of Voice of Health is to create safe spaces for people to feel heard, understood, and empowered. James took to this space after his own experience of supporting loved ones from an early age with their mental health. Our conversation today is going to center around building safe spaces, especially in the context of mental health. However, before we begin, we would like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. And now, without taking up much time, let's hear more from James. James, welcome back to the conversation. It's lovely to have you again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back on another very, very, very important subject. I think that is a perfect flow on from what we talked about last time and a very poignant one at that.
Absolutely. And for anyone, you know, like just before we kick off this conversation, we do have another conversation where we've dealt more in depth about active listening. So we will put a link below in the description. So if you want to check that out later, because that's going to be something we will touch upon briefly in this conversation. But James, more about what we're talking today, I think, you know, when we talk about mental health, and even if we look at the work that VOH does, one of the first things we talk about is, you know, building safe spaces. There's a lot of emphasis on, you know, let's create safe spaces, spaces where people can talk. But at no point have we really defined, you know, what is a safe space? So according to you, how would you, you know, first at the outset, what would you say is a safe space?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I think certainly in the context of like mental health or even just well-being support, a safe place is really a space where, you know, a person can feel that whatever they talk about or even just being there, that they're firstly validated, that they're accepted into that space, that it's, you know, it's non-judgmental, that they have the opportunity to be heard, and that I think it's a place where, you know, you don't necessarily walk straight in and you have that trust, but it's a place where you can really build up that trust over time, either with the other people in that space or the person that you're speaking to, or even just the environment itself. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of, you know, things like group therapy and stuff like that, where the safe place is, you know, you can even just come and not say anything, but if you just feel like like your existence in being there is accepted and validated, that is, I think, a really big part of what it means to create that safe place.
Right. I think, you know, like, and just moving further from this, like, you know, what would you say is sort of the role and the importance that safe spaces play, especially in a mental health context?
Yeah, I think once you have established a safe place, it does allow, you know, people to dive into, you know, the space of vulnerability. It helps them, you know, to really be able to feel like they can open up. It makes them feel like, you know, their ability to share is not going to be then passed on unnecessarily. And I think that, you know, none of us want to feel judged when we're sharing the things that are potentially upsetting us, you know, especially if they're linked to trauma or embarrassment or any sort of shame that we feel about having those things. And so if you can establish that safe place initially, you know, that's a fantastic foundation for any sort of growth or change or support environment. Because yeah, just, I think without that, you just, you know, no, even if you trust the person you're talking to, if it doesn't feel like a safe place, you're really not going to get the same outcomes. Because I think it's also just as important to feel like you can share with others as it is important to feel like you can actually, you know, dive in and discover some of even your own thoughts in a safe environment as well. Because, you know, we talk a lot about active listening, so it might not even necessarily be so much about, you know, getting advice or getting help. It might be that just like you need a safe place to feel like you can open up, and that whatever thoughts you discover on the spot aren't going to be judged. So I think there's so many different avenues for it, but it's essential, I think, for any good supportive relationship.
Right. And I think something very interesting that, you know, even you mentioned, it's about like feeling that you're not judged, right? And that's something we're going to come to a little later. But just to ask something, just to build on this a little further, is, you know, how do you think we can build safe spaces both online as well as offline. So, you know, especially be it in our homes, be it in, you know, the relationships that we have, or, you know, be it at work or in schools, you know, just generally, how do you think we can do that better?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to probably hear me say the words trust a lot. You know, even with the work that we do, we teach around the ability to build mm-hmm. trust online and offline. And there's so many different parts to the concept of building trust. And I think it's really one of those things that you want to try and do it from the outset. You know, you often hear people talk about, you know, first impressions last, and it really is a big part of that. And I think if right from the word go, you can make sure that if you're trying to provide a safe place for someone else, that you come to that environment yourself with the right intent of how can I help this person, rather than, you know, maybe your own agenda or your own bias in that situation. So you'll notice that you'll be able to establish that pretty quickly if you have the right intent, and then you really try and take the right steps to build trust. In an online space, it's a little bit more difficult. We certainly have that, you know, hurdle to jump over because of the fact that Vo is currently just messaging based. With the introduction of voice and video call, I think that's going to really help. But certainly in an online setting, you know, really watching your language and your tone. A lot of people not even necessarily aware that some of their language is judgmental, because once again, establishing a safe space is around making the person not feel like they're going to be judged in that moment. So I think if right from the word go, even if you have to verbalize it, even if you say this is a non-judgmental space, you can say absolutely anything you want here. It's all private and confidential, and everything you say stays between us. It's a very subtle thing, and you might think, oh, that's obvious. Couldn't I just show them that that's the case? It's like, but some people need to hear that. And so I think that can right. really help in cases. Yeah.
No, I think that is also something, you know, which people sometimes need to be told very explicitly, that, you know, what you say stays here, because they may have had a bad experience, or they may just need that validation, confirmation that, you know, this is a safe space, and it's sort of confirmed by both parties, right, that this is how we're going to work with it. But do you think in recent times, especially with the pandemic, do you think safe spaces have sort of gained an added importance? Because there's definitely been more conversation around safe spaces, but do you feel like their importance has increased?
Yeah, I think so, because I think a lot of people are I think a lot of people have been confronted with a lot of their own emotions that maybe they weren't aware. And I mm-hmm. think it actually does. It does tie into that kind of, you know, we talk about this loneliness epidemic, but there's the interesting thing I think a lot of people would have experienced is that they were having feelings of loneliness, even while maybe being surrounded by the people they live with or their partner. And so that, you know, that ability to be able to, you know, for our loved ones and ourselves to learn what it, means to provide a safe place. I think for a lot of people pre-pandemic, you know, they were able to almost kind of, you know, make their way through life without really actually digging down into what is maybe, you know, going on. And with COVID, I think a lot of people were kind of forced into a situation where they really had to reflect on how they felt. And so I think definitely, yeah, that that ability to be able to feel safe enough to go, hey, actually, you know what, COVID was really rough. And like, I realized that I'm not very good you know, when I'm by myself. A lot of people, you know, a lot of people not very capable of just being in their own company. And there's that whole, you know, there's a difference between being alone and being lonely. And so I think definitely during the pandemic, safe places became really important because, you know, even online, like even just coming into a Zoom call and feeling open enough to talk to someone, even if you couldn't see them because of restrictions, if that safe place could still be established, I think that probably helped a lot of people throughout those 2 years where it was really bad, especially here in Melbourne, where, you know, most locked down city in the world. Love that. But yeah, it became very, very important, I think.
Right. And I think, you know, as you said, like, you know, I think people were sort of confronted with things which they earlier might have avoided. So whether it was, you know, dysfunctional homes, or whether it's abuse, or even if it's just your intrusive thoughts. Earlier, I think people had more distractions. You could go out, you know, you could get busy working, you could spend extra hours working, all those kind of things. But suddenly you were just left by yourself to confront everything that you're going through. And, you know, just having some extra support available probably helped a lot of people through that time.
Definitely. Yeah. And I often, I think I called it emotional procrastination. previously, which is kind of almost something that we find ourselves doing, which is where, and for, especially for people, it's actually interesting. I found it happens a lot for people who are naturally empathetic as well. So what we do is we go, I'm empathetic, I'm helping others and I'm taking on their problems. But actually in some cases, we do that too much. And it's actually a procrastination to address the feelings that we're having for ourselves. So it's an interesting one because, you know, it's sometimes okay to be a little bit, you know, selfish and look after ourselves in those moments as well. So yeah, it certainly can play a lot of parts to it.
Right. I think I really love that term, like, you know, emotional procrastination, because it really puts into context everything that we go through a lot of times. And a lot of times I think people feel that, you know, if I tell someone what I'm going through, I'm going to burden them, especially in a mental health context, right? Like, I think there's so much stigma and then there's self-stigma. But there's also this fear that I'm going to, you know, burden someone else with my problem. So that's why I think, you know, just knowing that this is a non-judgmental space, that you're going to be supported, can go such a long way in making people feel more comfortable to open up. You know, I mean, like, how do you think we can make safe spaces more inclusive? Because that's also another challenge that a lot of people face, right?
Yeah, it's the inclusive part, I think, is an interesting one, because it's, I think, because there are those safe places for, like, you know, especially just with our peers and our friends. Certainly I know that, you know, some of my, within my friendship group, I've really, maybe I'm the advocate for it, but I do try and make sure that I establish a situation where everyone in the, every one of my friends or, you know, the people in my group, feel comfortable that even though we can all have a laugh and have fun and enjoy each other's company, that like it's okay to reach out and say, like, actually, I'm struggling a bit, I'm a bit stressed, a bit tired, you know, not feeling great, been a bit depressed recently, like feeling okay about that. Same with my family. I try and make sure that they feel the same way, that they can reach out and say that as well. And I think if you can establish that as like a baseline culture within your peers, I think that's a great way to have a safe place. Because then if you do that with all your friends, then, you know, when you're in the one-on-one situation, that can also be helpful. So that's, I think, for, you know, maybe a little less out of the mental health space, but just establishing that as a okay thing to do. It's not, it's a little, I mean, I don't want to have give the previous generation a hard time or anything, but I think this generation is much better at trying to establish that and being okay with that. Whereas previous generations haven't been so good at establishing that as the foundation for their relationships. As far as, I think, in a mental health space, I think it's just about making sure that we acknowledge everyone's lived experience as being unique. You know, even though we can find moments of common empathy, I think if you can, you know, establish that everyone's got a unique sense, you know, unique lived experience, and that, you know, struggle is subjective in that sense. And I think acknowledging what people have gone through and putting aside the bias or the agenda, I think makes everyone feel like they can be included in that conversation.
Right. And I think, you know, you just spoke about lived experience, and I know that's a huge conversation right now, especially in the mental health space, that, you know, while different people are going to come with different lived experiences, but do you feel that, you know, just having a lived experience is enough for you to sort of lead or head a safe space?
In a formal setting, so like in a casual setting between friends, like me coming out and saying, oh yeah, you know, to a friend of mine, let's say I had anxiety. If I said to my friend, hey, I have anxiety, this is what I've gone through, I think you can have a one-on-one relationship in a casual sense to talk about that. But as far as leading or building a safe place in a more kind of formal space, I think lived experience is an incredible tool. And it is really, really powerful to have, because it does give you a baseline level of empathy that you can build from. And it's, you know, it's going to be authentic and genuine when it comes to your intent. But I do think that it's both important for the people who maybe are being helped in that safe space, but also the person who is leading it. I think it is important for them to have at least some sort of kind of, you know, like training or some sort of at least guidance, or have at least kind of built up a set of skills that go along with that lived experience. Because, you know, even from an individual perspective, you know, there's a lot of compassion fatigue that comes with, you know, building or like leading a safe space. If you're especially in a group setting, it, it can be a lot because you're taking on, you know, all of the emotions of the group. So I think knowing when, you know, how to draw the line, knowing when you're getting triggered and all that type of stuff might be really important for an individual. And so you do need skills to accompany your lived experience in order to be able to do that. And then I think on the other, you know, on the other side, you know, you would want the people who are coming there to get support from someone else who has lived experience. You know, they're coming to get that support probably because they don't know how to properly shape their own lived experience and need a new perspective and need to be safely guided through that. So if they have someone who's just, you know, at the same point in their lived experience as them, it can be really powerful or it can be potentially damaging in some cases. So it does always help if the person, I think, leading it has at least some skills to help shape and mold their lived experience so that it can be, you know, passed on and used to help someone rather than hinder someone.
Right. So, you know, like one of the key things you just mentioned a lot of, like put a lot of emphasis on was like, you know, skills which need to be built. So, you know, what are some skills that you feel need to be curated if we want to cultivate safe spaces?
So, yeah, skills that need to be built to I think certainly your like communication is such an enormous part of it. You know, I think that often people go into a space and they go, oh, I have, you know, they think that their intention is enough. Right. And it is a wonderful thing. If you've got the right intention, there are so many people out there with the most beautiful intentions. And then I see them and I'm like, yeah, but your execution of passing that intention over was completely lost in your ability to communicate it. And so they got all the love in the world. They want to do their best, but then it comes across super judgmental. And then you're like, oh no, I know you meant the best, but the people you maybe were assisting didn't, or the language you used was maybe a little bit triggering, or, you know, in the moments where maybe that person just needed you to listen, you decided to give advice instead. And although I know it's because you wanted to help them, maybe that was a moment to just let them continue to share, or maybe you should have asked a question instead of saying a statement. So it's an interesting one in terms of, yeah, the skills needed to create. I would say communication is a really big one. And then I think also having the ability to be able to identify when your own lived experience is maybe making it too difficult for you to provide support to someone else, and the ability to be able to identify those emotions at the start rather than once you're too deep. And that's because then otherwise you get people who get, you know, they get vicarious trauma, they get compassion fatigue, they get burnout, all of these things. If you can have the skills to identify that as early as possible, I think that's also a really powerful skill to have for a safe space in a mental health setting. I think, you know, you can have more, you know, practical safe spaces as well, but I think as far as from a mental health perspective, those two are really, really important.
And coming back to, you know, some of the work that, you know, you've been doing at Voice of Health, y'all are really focused on, you know, the active listening part, especially in terms of, you know, curating safe spaces. So I know we've had a different discussion around, you know, what is active listening and all of that, but can you tell us a little bit about the role that active listening plays when it comes to, you know, sort of curating and building these safe spaces?
Yeah, definitely. And well, I mean, yeah, active listening, I mean, even in the title, it's that old line of there's a reason you've got two ears and one mouth. Because you should be listening twice as much as you speak. And I think that is kind of the first and foremost part around how active listening really does provide a safe place, because it's, you're making the person feel like there's a place where they belong, where they're being heard from both a, you know, factual, empathic, generative space. Your intent is correct. You've built up the, you know, that trust. It's, you know, trying to understand the motivation behind their feelings and thoughts, their perspectives. You're asking and crafting thoughtful questions. These are all fundamentals to active listening, but they're also fundamentals to someone feeling like the space that they're sharing is safe. And I think it's, yeah, we even have a whole section of our training that talks about shifting away from giving advice, because we often turn our good intentions into, oh, this works for me, let me give it to you. You know what I mean? Right. Here, take it. And they're like, no, you should do this. And then you should do this. And it's like, okay, but let's take on board exactly what they're going through in this moment, and let's make it so that they feel safe enough to share. And the safer you can make that space, the more progress you're going to actually have with that person. It's that, I don't know if I quoted the same thing last time, but it's the difference between transparency and vulnerability, which is that transparency is letting someone into your house, and vulnerability is letting someone into your house and then letting them move the furniture. And so it's that slight difference, is that the deeper the trust, the safer the space, the more vulnerable that person is going to feel like they can become. And that's going to naturally play into being a much more effective active listener, because it's going to allow them to explore their own feelings. Because it's that old, the best advice you get is the advice you give yourself. So if you can, once again, tie the safe place and active listening together, then you'll find that that person can explore those thoughts. And, you know, if you, it's kind of like wrapping them, it's kind of like, you know, nurturing them through the process as opposed to pushing them through the process.
Right. So I think that's also where, you know, like the whole aspect of, you know, building trust and building a rapport with the person becomes really important. But can you tell us a little bit about how we can actually build that trust, you know, especially when it's, let's say, a safe space where you need not have a, you know, relation with the person from before? Because if you know the person, as you said, you have some context to build on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one. One that is that I often it's interesting when I, because when I talk about this self-disclosure as a strategy to build trust, it depends who I'm talking to in the mental health space as to whether or not they believe it's a good idea. And usually the you get active listening, they're like, yep. Counselors are like, yep. Psychs are like, not sure. Psychiatrists are like, never.
No.
So it's, I call it scaled self-disclosure is a great way to build trust, which is about being able to adjust your level of self-disclosure in the moment to the situation. Because sometimes there's a lot of power in, you know, establishing that you show that you're willing to be vulnerable and self-disclose about yourself. And that can actually encourage others to feel the same, and that can build that bond. And you can, I think for a lot of people, you know, especially with self-disclosure, it's important to know how to do it. So it does actually come back to that communication point a little bit as well, because you also don't want to take the attention away from the person in that moment as well. So I often use the line of like, it can be even as simple as, oh, you know, I understand exactly those feelings. I've had some of those feelings myself in the past. And that's like, I haven't taken the attention away from you, but I've normalized your feelings. I've made you feel accepted. And I've also disclosed that I've experienced something similar, and then let you continue from that point. So that's self-disclosure is a really big one. Vulnerability is a big one. The one where you haven't, I guess, met each other before is always an interesting one. So it does come down to, like, I guess, the nature of the situation. If it's just a friendly environment, you know, I always say, take an interest. It was an old thing. I think my mum must have said it to me, which was always be interested, not interesting. Which is about really having a genuine inquiry for the person, because it then also taps into everyone's favorite subject is themselves. So if they feel like you actually really care, and you can ask those questions, and you actually care, that's a really great way to establish trust. What's another one? I'm trying to think of a few of them. Yeah, obviously the non-judgmental questioning and watching your tone and stuff like that. People often talk about mirroring, but that is, I think it's an interesting one. I would always just say it's like, rather than mirroring a person's body language or the way that they talk, I often just say mirror their energy in a sense. So understand where they're at. Like, you know, sometimes people come in too intense for someone who's quite shy and you're like, you haven't matched their intensity. So that can be a good way to build trust. There's quite a few, to be honest. But the list could go on, but I don't want to take up the whole time talking about how to build trust.
No, I think these are interesting, right? Because especially when you come to talking about like self-disclosure, it becomes a space where you have to really draw that line between, okay, like I get you and, you know, like I know what you're talking about. I feel for you, like the whole empathizing aspect of self-disclosure versus, okay, you know what, now I'm going to hijack this conversation and make it all about me. And this is what happened to me. And then, you know, you'll head down the train of giving advice. So a space where, you know, I think when you're building trust, I think people feel, if they feel that you're genuinely interested in what they have to say, they're going to be probably, as you said, more vulnerable because they feel cared for, rather than, you know, you're just not here to just hear them out, but you're going to listen.
Yep.
I think definitely. That's, you know, like between people being transparent and probably them moving that step forward towards being vulnerable. But also coming towards, you know, like, Look, as human beings, we all have had different experiences. We're all going to have a different frame of reference. But more than that, we're also going to have our own judgments and stigma and our own biases within us. So how do you think that that would play out, especially when it comes into, you know, building safe spaces for other people?
Yeah, it's such a fantastic question. And I had this conversation the other day with someone around the benefits, the advantages and disadvantages of our judgments, and the fact that there's an enormous difference between being judgmental and having judgments. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because realistically our judgments are what has helped us survive as a race. You know, we knew that the tiger that was going to eat us when we were cavemen was probably bad. So our judgment kept us alive. So, but then, you know, we come into conversations these days, and I think judgments or our biases, if you're not aware of them, then they can be harmful to creating safe space, because you're naturally creating almost an echo chamber of your own biases if you're trying to cultivate a safe place that only plays into them. But if you're aware of them, you can actually use them as something that can be in some cases powerful as well. This is often related to something we always talk about, which is downloading listening, which is around listening based on your pre-existing judgments of the situation and what you already know. And so the example I often give is if I was talking to someone and they were saying, oh, I've actually been suffering from some anxiety recently. The part where judgments is helpful is that maybe, you know, everything I've learned about anxiety previously, or even just through my own lived experience, forms a foundation of knowledge and a foundation of understanding. So that's okay. But if I let that only be the thing that determines how I listen to this person, then I've only applied what I already know to this person, and I haven't acknowledged who they are. So it has an advantage as a foundation, but I think you need to make sure that you're aware of that so that you can put it aside when you need to and build on top of it and really make an effort to learn about that person. And that's where empathy comes in, and factual listening and things like that, where you actually have the foundation, but then build on top of it. And it's hard because downloading listening and that type of, you know, our judgments, they're our default. They're who we are. And sometimes we don't even realize that they're there. Until, you know, we see them play out. But certainly stigmas, I think the stigmas are a bit different. Biases and judgments, they're ingrained in us. And so being aware of them is important. Stigmas, I think often, you know, you don't really hear, I mean, you do hear some people say positive stigma, but it's not often, you usually hear negative stigma. You know, it's not often people going, oh, what a great stigma this topic has. You know what I mean? It doesn't happen. And so I think stigmas are bad, because that is, now you are being judgmental towards that person in that sense. Mm-hmm. And it's a clear way of saying, actually, I'm not putting aside my own judgments, or I'm not, sorry, my own judgmental phrases or judgmental language. It's, I'm actually going to bring that and I'm going to apply it to you so that you fit my idea of what you should be.
And I think, you know, with the stigma, as you said, it's not, I think the word itself has a very negative connotation, but it is not essentially something which is very positive, right? Because firstly, yeah, it's something we've acquired. It's not something we're born with. I don't think we're born with, you know, all the perceptions that we have around mental health. But when the stigma comes into the picture, and of course, there's different kinds of stigma, and we've seen it within the mental health space as well, where, you know, certain diagnoses are treated with far heavier stigma than, you know, other diagnoses, especially when it comes to personality disorders, whether it's, you know, emotionally unstable personality disorder. We know the kind of bias and the weight that label itself carries. But, you know, how do you think we can park aside our biases and our stigma, especially if we, you know, gradually become aware of them? Because sometimes we're not aware of them, and that's going to come with the experience, where, you know, in a few conversations, you realize that, oh my God, I come from this place of bias.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, especially when it comes to supporting others, putting aside your bias, my number one tip for that would be is that treat that person as if they're a human, not their diagnosis is the biggest one. Is that, because if you go, I'm talking to this person who's got emotional, some sort of disorder, right? And you label that person as that, you haven't acknowledged who they are as a person. You've acknowledged their diagnosis. You know, it's something that they're experiencing. It's not who they are. It's this sense. Look, it might be a horrible thing that they're experiencing with their mental health, but I guess that, you know, if you go to the default of everyone is a human, and at the end of the day, then I think that is, you know, like, do we have a bias against humans? Not really. You know, it's like, everyone's a human. What's your bias? Nothing. So start from that point and then build from there. But if you go like, I've learned all of these different things about all these different disorders, and the person I last met who had this disorder was this, well, then now you're applying everything. You're once again applying your judgments and your biases. Whereas if you start from this person is a human and this human is experiencing this, it's a much easier way to put aside your bias, because you just see them as like, you know, it's empowering too, because you suddenly go, yeah, you don't come at every situation being judgmental or skeptical about this person. You just go like, I want to learn about this wonderful human. Let's see how it goes.
And I think that's where, you know, like sometimes when you look at mental health, like, you know, also on a continuum that, you know, 1 in 5 of us are going to have a mental health, like a mental illness, but 5 in 5 of us still have mental health. So if we look at it in a more humanizing context, that, you know, it's something we're all going to go through. And if it's not, like, not everyone you're going to speak to is going to have a mental illness. Sometimes you may just feel, you know, it may not be like a diagnosis, but you may still feel that niggling feeling inside, which you need to talk to someone about. So just giving people that space, rather than also like not diagnosing them, right? Like, just because you know so much about anxiety doesn't give you the right to label someone with an anxiety disorder. I think we have to leave that sort of to the people who are in charge of it. Like, professionals do the diagnosis. You're just there to support someone through it.
Totally. No, I totally agree.
So another thing would be that, you know, we talk a lot about boundaries as well, like individual boundaries, like boundaries with other people. Do you think we need boundaries when it comes to creating safe spaces and within our safe spaces?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I think that the boundaries... yeah, there's a few different elements to it. I think the boundaries would come from, you know, the boundaries around how, you know, how much advice can be given in those spaces, depending on what type of safe space it is. I think it's an interesting one when people talk about like setting boundaries around what people are allowed to share. I don't think that that's healthy. I think that if someone suddenly feels that they are in a safe place where they, if a safe place has been established and the person feels that, I think they should be open to being able to share that. I had a fantastic conversation multiple times with a guy called Matt Ball. He's within this space. And one of his favorite lines was, just because I mentioned the word suicide doesn't mean I need an ambulance at the front door. And so it was about like, well, you know, we should be able to share these feelings and thoughts that go through our head that are maybe serious and maybe confronting, but, you know, in a safe way where I can explore it. And if I feel safe enough to open up about that, that should be a wonderful thing, not something that is seen as me being ill. And so I think there's that side of it as well, which is like, you know, boundaries becomes a bit interesting, because then you go like, where do we set it? But then I do understand that, obviously, you know, you also want to establish an environment where people feel like if a conversation went to that level, that they could go, actually, you know what, I'm just getting a bit triggered for this. Do you mind if we just hold on a moment and just make it sure that people feel like they can open up for that? I think as far as a boundary for maybe like someone who's purely supporting as a peer or as someone within the lived experience space, I think it goes back to that. Yeah, fortunately, it's not really their place to diagnose. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where you've got to really make sure you establish the boundaries. And it comes down to just knowing your own limits and what you're, you know, trained to do in that situation. I think that, you know, the boundaries of sharing is, you know, can be very, very wide. But I think, you know, going, oh, it sounds like you have PTSD, or you must have PTSD, or you must have an eating disorder, you know, just based on the similarities between our situations, is like, and that's where you really got to set the boundaries, because maybe that person hadn't previously identified themselves as someone who had that, and you've now created a situation where it's much worse because you haven't had boundaries in that moment. Boundaries is an interesting conversation. It's certainly interesting.
How do you think, like, you know, boundaries sort of in a way protect safe spaces?
Yeah, look, yeah, they protect it because I think they set the guidelines for the environment. It helps to keep some structure to the situation because, you know, the human mind is not a very, it's both very structured and very unstructured in some cases. And so without those boundaries, maybe, you know, the purpose of the space is not properly established or people don't understand the intention of what the space is for. So, you know, depending on where you are. So, you know, if you talk to a psychologist, what the boundaries of that conversation are very different to maybe what the boundaries of a group therapy situation might be, or a one-on-one peer support conversation, or a lived experience worker or psychiatrist. All of these different conversations will have different boundaries, but each of them are trying to establish a safe place where someone feels like they can share. So I think boundaries are really important for that. But yeah, also for the, not only for the people who are sharing, but also for the people who are providing support as well. I think it's, yeah, especially when you get into maybe the group stuff, it's like maybe there has to be boundaries because the people in the space are not equipped themselves to be able to handle that conversation as well.
So, especially also around, you know, boundaries, especially in group settings around confidentiality, that, you know, what gets discussed in the group stays in the group, but definitely. Also around safeguarding. Like, you know, as you said, that if someone mentions that they are feeling suicidal, do they need like an ambulance at their door, or is this just a thought with no plan? So I think even to kind of have that conversation to explore where are you at. But sometimes also the conversations can be very triggering to the person leading the safe space, right? As you said, you can have vicarious trauma, you can go through compassion fatigue, you can have burnout. You can go through so many things, as well as you yourself might feel very triggered. Because if you don't, like sometimes you can't tell the person, hey, you know, talk to me about everything but this. Because if that thing comes up, the person's going to feel very guilty, or they're going to have to hold back through the course of conversation. So as a listener, or as, you know, the person leading that safe space, you know, what are some ways to look after your own self?
Yeah, I would say, first and foremost, address it as early as possible. Like, even if you just have a small hunch that you're about to be triggered, or you're feeling like it's affecting you in a way that might send you in a particular direction, do it as early as possible. I think it's healthier that way, because you're then going to be able to communicate that better, rather than waiting until you are maybe a little further down the track in terms of maybe some emotional triggering. Mm-hmm. Because when you're at that point, your brain is in self-preservation mode, but you're trying to communicate to others. And so it becomes much more difficult, rather than if you're right at the beginning with the preventative, you go, hey, can you just give me like a quick moment? I just need to just process that. I'm just noticing that I'm having some feelings arise from this. I don't want to stop this, but I just want to make sure that I'm on top of my own feelings here, so that you can continue to feel like you can share. And the earlier you do that, and even if you say right at the beginning, like, hey, if there's ever anything that's triggering, I just want to let you know, I might just ask you to pause. It's not me shutting you down. It's just me needing a moment to collect my own thoughts, because it's obviously going to be an emotional conversation. If you set that expectation right at the beginning, then when it happens later on, it's a much better way to do it. I think that, that would be my number one thing, is to do it as early as possible and set the intention that that could be happening. Like what you did with this podcast, it might be emotionally triggering for you. So be prepared. And if it is, then just say it. And if one of us felt triggered in this conversation, we would feel safe enough to just say, just give me a moment. I need to just process this. And so I think that would be my number one tip in terms of doing that, is address it early. Because you're just not going to be in the right frame of mind to do it later.
Right. And also I think around self-care, it becomes so important, right? To like take a step back and not make sure that, you know, like if you can do this much for other people, you also have to look after yourself and not make sure that you've taken on too much. Because sometimes, you know, if you are in a position where you're caring for someone or you're an active listener, it can be very easy to get sort of, I don't want to say carried away, but essentially like not have that boundary that this is where I need to stop and take a step back for myself.
Definitely. Yeah. And you will always be a better version and a better support to someone else if you've put your own well-being first. Because, you know, the version of me that is worn out, emotionally fatigued, you know, burnt out as well. That version of me trying to support someone is not as good as the version of me that is, has looked after himself, has taken that self-care, is in the right space emotionally, and is then going to come at the conversation with the right intent. You know, in both cases, I'm helping, but one in one situation, it's a much better experience. And that person's going to feel that energy and that intent, and it's going to be more powerful. But yeah, a lot of people, they, you know, especially, you know, there's people out there in friendship groups who are, they're the emotional support for the whole group. And that is what then becomes the validation from them for themselves. They go, mm-hmm. I'm the rock. I'm that protector. I'm the rock of my group. And that's emotionally fatiguing because you then feel like you can't stop that. But then people forget that if they don't stop that, then they're going to be a worse version of that rock for everyone anyway. So it's, it's an interesting one.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, like if you are that person who's taken on everybody's responsibility and you feel like that rock at some point, you need to be taken care of as well. Mm. So you can't sort of spend all your energy looking after everyone else, because as they say, you can't pour from an empty cup.
True. I like that. You can't pour from an empty cup. That's perfect.
Which is where the whole notion of self-care and, you know, the whole you've got to nourish to flourish sort of comes in, that you can't sort of ignore your needs just because you're looking after someone.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's so true. Yeah, I'm probably gonna steal that. You can't pour from an empty cup. I've heard it before, but I'm gonna steal it now because it's a good one. Because I do talk about that. I think a lot of people, they go like, oh no, I don't want to be selfish. And it's like, it's not selfish. It's not selfish at all. If it is selfish, it's the best version of selfish, because your intention behind looking after yourself is so that you can be there for others in a better way. So I think it's really, really important.
I think that's also one of the misconceptions, right, around self-care, that we look at it as selfish. And maybe that's where somewhere, you know, maybe social media plays out, right? Because a lot of times when you see what self-care looks like, a lot of people misunderstand self-care for like indulgence or like, you know, overspending. And that's not necessarily what self-care has to look like. I mean, it can look different for different people, but that misconception somewhere makes it look like, no, this is really selfish, but you have to look after your own self, right, at the end of the day, because how are you going to, even if you want to support other people, like, as you said, that good kind of selfish, you need to look after your own self, because if you're, let's say, constantly, you're ignoring your meals or you're not sleeping, you're going to come into that conversation really drained out. And if people start mirroring each other's energy, then that's it. I mean, you're just going to have a very drained out conversation at the end of it.
Definitely. And it's interesting. I like that. You're 100% right that the word indulgence, I think, is an interesting one. We do often interpret self-care as an indulgence or a luxury, you know, because you see, you know, I always laugh at those ones, you know, like when people make like their breakfast and they make like a perfectly crafted smoothie bowl. And I'm like, I respect everyone who does that, because I'm like, it feels like it would be a luxury to have the amount of time. It probably doesn't take long at all, but it's kind of that, you kind of feel that mental energy of going like, geez, self-care, look after myself, I got to put that much effort in. But in reality, it doesn't. It could be just taking 10 minutes for yourself, or like when you have your morning coffee, don't go straight to your desk. Take a moment, sit away from it, look out the window instead.
Simply don't doom scroll, especially in today's era. Like, don't doom scroll, don't check social media, don't read the news the first thing you wake up. Can also be a lot of self-care, right? Because people are having a hard time. It can look different for different people, right? For someone, reading a book could be self-care. For someone, going out or, you know, just going on a run or going swimming could be self-care. So I think it's going to look different, but I think just knowing that you need to do it
definitely
is the main thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mine is have my coffee and don't go. And if I remember, don't go to my desk. That's my big one. It's like, cause I got to go past a couch from my kitchen to my desk. And so sometimes I'm just like, okay, just stop at the couch, sit with the coffee and just enjoy the coffee. Don't just mindlessly drink it at your desk while you do your emails. Even just that little moment can be enough.
It is. Yeah. It's a big thing, right? Like just taking that me time for yourself and not feeling guilty about it.
Definitely. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. It's the guilt. The guilt is such a big thing. You go like, oh, I feel guilty for doing this thing for myself. And like, oh, I should be working. Trust me, as a as a business owner, that guilt is real. That guilt is so real. I can't even like even taking a night off to like maybe watch a movie, which is like an hour and a half. I'll be watching the movie feeling guilty. So I know that exact feeling. It's not an easy one to combat sometimes.
I think sometimes just being aware, like this is also in a way like our own judgment, right? Like these are the notions we've built. And just being aware of it will really help, like when we're supporting someone else as well, because you can reduce that guilt and that burden that they're feeling by telling them that, no, it's okay. And sometimes people need that validation that it's okay if I'm doing this. And yes, someone else has been through it as well, but it's fine. Like it's fine to firstly be feeling like this around these thoughts, but also it's okay to still go ahead and do it without feeling guilty or, you know, just sort of gaslighting your own self almost for needing some time off.
Self-gaslighting. I haven't heard that before, but I like it.
But it is something that we end up doing, right? Like, especially in this whole era of like hustling and, you know, like toxic productivity, we just have this urge to keep being busy. And if we're not, we're going to start shaming ourselves and telling ourselves that we're not doing enough. And knowing, just being aware, coming back to just being aware that we have these feelings or that these are some biases that we've acquired along the way can really help us also be more empathetic towards other people and kind of understand where they might be coming from.
Oh, definitely. It's funny. I teach a workshop around work-life balance, which is an interesting one. I do my own kind of take on it, which is that like it talks a little bit about self-care, but it's about, we do it in relation to like an employment space, which is around understanding that not everyone has the same percentage of work-life balance. Some people have a 90-10 balance and that's enough, 80-20, 60-40, 70-30, 50-50, whatever it is. We're all unique in that sense. And I think that it's important to be able to acknowledge that and empathize with what others need. Because it's also then, once again, it's like subjective productivity. It's like, you know, what we expect, what some people are capable of is not going to be what others are capable of, but that doesn't make one better or worse. It's just about understanding who's who and what their needs are. So I think it's an interesting kind of subject to explore for sure.
I think, again, that ties into our lived experience, right? That everyone's not going to have the same cookie cutter lived experience. So let's say even if we take depression, two people are going to experience depression very differently. And the thing that will bother them about their depression may also be different. So someone may be extremely high functioning, where for them, not being able to be productive might be the hardest part. But for someone else, the thing that might bother them the most is just not being able to sleep, for instance, you know, like, or sleep disturbances. So again, just knowing that different people are going to go through things differently, like even if it's something like work-life balance, because I think so many things tie into the mental health conversation. So just knowing that, hey, we're unique, we're going to have different perspectives of looking at this. Our entire frame of reference is going to be different. But yeah, just being able to park that aside makes a big difference.
Definitely.
So James, to wrap up everything that we spoke about today, what are your parting words going to be, let's say, to anyone who's, you know, watching or listening to this today, who might be having a hard time with their mental health right now?
Oh, that's a big one. I think for anyone who's out there who is struggling with their mental health at this stage, I think understanding that, you know, well, I mean, it's interesting with the pandemic being on top of that, is that we actually all have one unique common empathy that we all can share. And so if you ever had any fear around reaching out to someone and starting a conversation around having struggled over the last 2 years, or even right now, even if it's not related to the pandemic, you've now got your almost cold opener in terms of opening up that dialogue to start talking about what you went through. And maybe that's the catalyst for a deeper conversation around what you're struggling with, because I think, yeah, a lot of people felt very lonely during this time. And I think, you know, it's exacerbated a lot of people's mental health struggles, but I think knowing that we all now have one common lived experience will help you feel more empowered to be able to better connect with others. Seek out the people that seek out people who you feel provide you with a safe place to open up. because even if they never give you any advice, if you feel like you can share with them, that's powerful enough as a starting point for sure. And Voice of Health is a great place to do that. But that wasn't the purpose of that. But yeah, you know what I mean.
I know too. So thank you for taking our time to, you know, do this with us. And it's been great to have you back and, you know, have this conversation, which kind of builds in on what we previously discussed, but also something which is so often mentioned, but not really addressed, right? We have so many conversations, as I said at the beginning, that, you know, what do we need? How can we be better at mental health support? And we always focus around, okay, let's build safe spaces. But, you know, I think hopefully this will give people that insight and, you know, how you can be a safe space. Because a safe space is not just a physical space. It's also a very emotional thing. So, you know, how do you let people know that, you know, the equation that you share essentially is a safe space. So for anyone who's listening to this, watching this today, just know that, you know, if you're having a hard time with your mental health, there is help out there. There are resources out there. There's support out there. So please, you know, share what you're feeling and know that it gets better. You're not alone in this. So till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.